together in a harmonious manner have unraveled into two competing ideologies. The modern origins of freedom as freedom from lie in the social contract tradition of political theory, Hobbes, Locke, and in the French Enlightenment. In her excellent treatment of the Enlightenment, Mary Gregory notes, "In the 18th century, liberty referred to the power to either choose or to refrain from choosing, to not being forced to submit to the commands of another human being, to the state of being a free man as opposed to being a slave, to the form of government in which sovereign power resides in the nobility or in the people, to the ability to be able to do what one wants to do without being restrained from doing it." We saw in Chapter 2 that Rousseau expected the government to make positive contributions to the quality of life of its citizens. Gregory notes that he viewed inequality, luxury, and greed not as natural, but rather as evils that resulted when men banded together to form societies, and opposed the despotic tendencies of unrestrained government. By contrast, Voltaire, sounding rather like Adam Smith, wrote that selfishness, greed, and the desire for luxury were useful features of human nature. Wrapped together under the heading of the profit motive, these desires, Voltaire claimed, are the reasons that humans search and invent. The state should allow these selfish motivations to be manifested, since they drive people to achieve more, which is the cornerstone of human progress. In his insightful book, Capitalism and Freedom, The Contradictory Character of Globalization, Peter Nolan summarizes the net result of these developments. Social Darwinism was a political philosophy that was strongly opposed to any form of state interference with the natural workings of society. Laws regulating labor conditions were seen as a form of slavery, since they interfered in the rights of free agents to dispose of their property as they saw fit. The idea that freedom essentially meant freedom of contract became the bedrock of liberal thinking at the end of the 19th century. These results are not surprising. If an implied social contract is taken as the justification for the state and the basis of its authority, then all the functions of the government need to be channeled through this framework. Freedom is about control of one's property, wealth. Government exists to protect propertied individuals, and interference with the dynamics of wealth acquisition are unnatural. Of even more concern are the dimensions of civic life that cannot be conceived from the neoliberal paradigm. Rights such as those emphasized by David Harvey, the right to life chances, control over production by the direct producers, a decent and healthy living environment, collective control of common property resources. It was thus the British and French philosophers of the modern period who formed the link between freedom and capitalism. Freedom, understood as non-interference with the pursuit of self-interest, was said to require capitalism as the only system that allows humans to be genuinely free, and capitalism, the economic system of preference for the moderns, would only be able to succeed if the capitalists were free from all constraints by governments and other sources. Only if capitalists enjoy a completely free market, note how this phrase reduces freedom to a mere adjective modifying market, will they be able to bring the immense benefits to humankind that their wealth can procure. Each term is defined or redefined in terms of the other, not in terms of any broader goals. The capitalist's freedom from becomes the central motor of the capitalist economy. Nowhere is this capitalist manifesto expressed more clearly than in the classic work by Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom. Viewed as a means to the end of political freedom, economic arrangements are important because of their effect on the concentration or dispersion of power. The kind of economic organization that provides economic freedom directly, namely competitive capitalism, also promotes political freedom because it separates economic power from political power and in this way enables the one to offset the other. Historical evidence speaks with a single voice on the relation between political freedom and a free market. I know of no example in time or place of a society that has been marked by a large measure of political freedom, and that has not also used something comparable to a free market to organize the bulk of economic activity. However, the evidence of the last decades undercuts Friedman's claims in multiple ways. Instead of government that, as he writes, separates economic power from political power, Americans are seeing government increasingly serving business interests. Recent court decisions are allowing businesses and extremely wealthy individuals to play an increasing role in financing candidates and thereby influencing the outcome of state and national elections. Since 2008, the phrase, "too big to fail," has been added to the national vocabulary. This phrase communicates that banks and other businesses are crucial to national security, so that it becomes the government's responsibility to keep them functioning, no matter how badly they have been managed and no matter what the cost to American taxpayers. By contrast, one never hears the phrase, "too poor to be neglected." At the same time that tax laws and bailouts increasingly support the rich, basic social services are being cut for the world's poorest people. The reductio ad absurdum of human freedom is clearly and painfully expressed in this statement by former U.S. President George W. Bush. The concept of free trade arose as a moral principle even before it became a pillar of economics. If you can make something that others value, you should be able to sell it to them. If others make something that you value, you should be able to buy it. This is real freedom, the freedom for a person or nation to make a living. Freedom for community. Marx was very critical of the way that freedom of trade tended to subordinate all other forms of freedom in Western society. In reality, there are multiple types of freedom, each with their own internal logic, which must be encouraged and balanced. Freedom of trade, Marx says, is not a bad thing in itself, but it can become tyrannical if it is allowed to become the measure of all types of social freedom. He writes, "Freedom of trade, freedom of property, of conscience, of the press, of the courts, are all species of one and the same genus, of freedom without any specific name. But it is quite incorrect to forget the difference because of the unity, and to go so far as to make a particular species the measure, the standard, the sphere of other species. This is an intolerance on the part of one species of freedom, which is only prepared to tolerate the existence of others if they renounce themselves and declare themselves to be its vassals." Marx advocates for a more holistic definition of freedom, writing, "Free activity for the communists is the creative manifestation of life arising from the free development of all abilities of the whole person. This idea of freedom must be taken up and developed further in an organic, postmodern worldview." The philosopher of constructive postmodernism, Alfred North Whitehead, offers an antidote to the narrowing of human freedom similar to that of Marx. He links freedom to the open-ended creativity of human civilization and the process of life. The capacity that we call freedom is what lures individuals and societies to move beyond existing outworn structures. As he writes, "The social value of liberty lies in its production of discords. There are perfections beyond perfections. Thus, the contribution to beauty, which can be supplied by discord, in itself destructive and evil, is the positive feeling of a quick shift of aim from the tameness of outworn perfection to some other ideal with its freshness still upon it." For the philosophers of ecological civilization, the emphasis falls first on the freedom to actualize the huge potential that beckons to each individual and society. We actualize our potential when we are offered educational and cultural opportunities, and when basic needs for food, shelter, and safety are met. It is not enough merely to offer people the chance to pursue self-interest without interference from other humans and from governments. Criticizing the freedom from paradigm, Whitehead writes, "When we think of freedom, we are apt to confine ourselves to freedom of thought, freedom of the press, freedom for religious opinions. Then the limitations to freedom are conceived as wholly arising from the antagonisms of our fellow men. This is a thorough mistake. The massive habits of physical nature, its iron laws, determine the scene for the sufferings of men. In modern thought, the expression of this truth has taken the form of the economic interpretation of history." The great Harvard economist and philosopher Amartya Sen has recently proposed that we understand not GDP, but freedom, understood in terms of social or communal well-being and not solely private protections, as the measure of development. He writes, "It is important to give simultaneous recognition to the centrality of individual freedom and to the force of social influences on the extent and reach of individual freedom. To counter the problems that we face, we have to see individual freedom as a social commitment. Expansion of freedom is viewed, in this approach, both as the primary end and as the principal means of development." In Sen's view, the success of a civilization is measured not just in terms of how quickly it produces capital. Have we really won if we achieve a rapid rise in GDP at the cost of decimating the environment, dropping more and more families below the poverty line, and neglecting education, culture, and quality of life? Human rights. We have already seen how the language of freedom naturally expands into the language of rights. The First Amendment of the American Bill of Rights already speaks of the rights of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion. Rights language has become an indispensable component of international discourse in the global community. Three features of rights language demand our attention. First, the age is gone when all nations will agree on a list of human rights on the grounds that they are valued by a single religion and its sacred scriptures. International lists of rights, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, reflect increasing agreement across the planet about how humans, and increasingly animals and the environment, may and may not be treated. Without a doubt, the core values of each culture and its religion continue to play a significant role in explaining and justifying rights language for members of that culture. But local concepts and stories, even if religiously grounded, cannot produce global consensus about universal human rights. This is one reason why the global community speaks increasingly of natural rights, not of God-given rights. The power of rights language is not weakened if, globally, they represent nothing more and nothing less than the strong consensus of the global community. Second, agreement on universal human rights is higher and stronger than it has ever been before in human history. The category of basic human rights will not go away. The growing strength of rights language is especially notable given that, during the same period, skepticism has grown about traditional ways of grounding rights language. It is the third point, however, that will demand most of our attention. It is this. The historical narrative shows a distinct progression through three types of human rights. This evolution is so clear and so important that one can actually judge political philosophies based on whether they are able to conceive all three types of rights and to explain the progression among them. Any political theory that fails this test, we suggest, will not be adequate to today's global situation. Moreover, we suggest, organic Marxism is particularly well suited to this task. We follow Arya Nair in describing the three types as blue, red, and green rights. Roughly, on his model, blue rights are civil and political rights, the rights to individual liberties, similar to the freedom from that we explored above. Red rights are economic and social rights, rights that focus more on the quality of life. Green rights are collective rights, such as the right to peace, or the rights of future generations to environmental resources and the biodiversity necessary for human survival. Each of the three types includes the preceding one, but also adds to it. The movement through the three types offers an excellent way of understanding rights language. Blue rights. The emergence of the distinctively modern tradition of rights begins with blue rights. Modern human rights were initially based on the assumption that societies function best when governments allow citizens to pursue their own self-interest without interference. Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. Nair notes, as seen from the perspective of James Madison and those who contributed to the thinking that went into his writing of the American Bill of Rights, the concept of rights referred exclusively to civil and political rights, that is, rights that limit the power of the state to interfere with certain actions of citizens and that empower citizens to influence the actions of the state. Note that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, which is the foundational document for the modern human rights movement, also focuses on civil and political rights, but does include some recognition of social and economic rights, such as rights to social security, employment, leisure, and education. Michelin Ishay's important History of Human Rights makes clear what are the consequences of focusing exclusively on blue rights. Adam Smith observed that a civil government established for the purpose of protecting property rights is, in his words, in reality instituted for the defense of the rich against the poor, or of those who have property against those who have none at all. Yet the forces of the market, he explained, constituted a mechanism that would drive the prices of commodities down to their natural and most affordable level. It is no coincidence that blue is also a symbol of the aristocracy, as in the expression blue bloods. In early modern Europe, any positive consequences for persons without property, one could not even speak of them as having rights at the time, were only byproducts of protecting the property rights of the wealthy. As Ishay shows, independents and levelers alike equated political freedom with some sort of individual property ownership and independence. Thus, they introduced the liberal notion that freedom is first earned through independent economic activity. Although the right to the vote remained limited, the right to property was eventually won, albeit at a high human cost, and feudal land tenures and arbitrary taxation were abolished in England. If one can speak of rights for the poor, it was only by a kind of secondary application of the rights enjoyed by the wealthy. Thus, John Locke wrote in The Two Treatises that every man has a property in his person. This nobody has a right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hand, we may say, are properly his. The early American leaders took a similar view. They assumed that the right to vote should be contingent on ownership of land and property, because only land ownership shows sufficient evidence of attachment to the community. In short, the modern European thinkers saw democracy as a sort of byproduct of property ownership, and of the conditions necessary for protecting it. Kant writes that civil freedom could no longer be infringed without disadvantage to all trades and industries, and especially to commerce. As Nair correctly notes, that view, especially unchanged since its 18th century origins, would find expression in the post-Cold War foreign policy doctrine of the world's only superpower, which linked world peace to the synergetic expansion of markets and democracy. Red and Green writes, "We have seen that, in the beginning, individual human rights in Western Europe were extensions of property rights. Classical liberalism eventually extended these initial rights into other kinds of blue rights, that is, other rights of individual choice. But the grounding of these new rights continued to follow the logic of individualism and property ownership out of which they were born. Red rights are not primarily concerned with the ability of individuals to freely pursue self-interest, but with securing basic needs for each individual while pursuing the good of the community. The concept of red rights began to play a role as philosophers realized that individual choices rely in various ways on communal values and community cooperation. If individual property owners act only to acquire more wealth for themselves, the society will not actually continue to function. Socialists, communists, Marxists, and their allies attempted to move the conversation beyond the rights of individual choice to include the economic and social rights that are necessary for a well-ordered society. Central to the international human rights movement have been documents such as the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, proposed for ratification by the United Nations in 1966. In addition to the right to just and favorable conditions at work, and to the right to form trade unions, the International Covenant includes a variety of social and cultural rights that go significantly beyond the limitations of blue rights thinking. The states parties to the present covenant recognize the right of everyone to education. They agree that education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and the sense of its dignity, and shall strengthen the respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. They further agree that education shall enable all persons to participate effectively in a free society, promote understanding, tolerance, and friendship among all nations and all racial, ethnic, or religious groups, and further the activities of the United Nations for the maintenance of peace. To include rights to employment, healthcare, and education, as well as the right to participate in cultural life, is to move into the heart of red rights. It is to take a perspective on what all human beings need if they are to thrive. To conceive rights in this way is to see society organically, as an interconnected system. Unlike the blue rights paradigm, organic thinking recognizes that it is neither just nor healthy when many live a truncated existence so that a small portion of citizens can thrive. On this view, the blue right, not to be interfered with, is seen as a fungible right. When free market profits for some come at great cost for many others, the national and international community is justified to rebalance society so that all can enjoy a basic quality of life. Freedom from interference is a good, but it is not the only good. Green rights represent the final step toward an organic worldview. Here, it is not only the quality of life of all humans that is taken into account, but also the survival of non-human animals and ecosystems. Just as economic, social, and cultural rights can't be established on the basis of freedom from interference alone, so also the right to a healthy environment goes beyond the perspective of both blue and red thinking. One of the founding fathers of socialist and communist thought, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, began to develop the framework for this extended view of rights in 1840. Proudhon pointed to the existence of a third category, a right outside of society. He wrote that a property is, quote, "a right outside of society, for it is clear that if the wealth of each was social wealth, the conditions would be equal for all, and it would be a contradiction to say, property is a man's right to dispose at will of social property. Then, if we are associated for the sake of liberty, equality, and security, we are not associated for the sake of property. Then, if property is a natural right, this natural right is not social." Proudhon challenged the inclusion of property in the list of natural rights set forth in the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, preferring social ownership of the means of production. The early socialist resistance to all private property turned out to be unworkable, however, and most Marxists today combine social principles with some private ownership. Socialism has to be open to all human civilizations, including the capitalist systems, in order to show its advantage. It must absorb and learn from all advanced business models and management methods of all countries, including developed capitalist countries, which reflected the law of modern socialized production. But Proudhon also included proto-ecological reasons for his conclusion. He argued that one's labor does not entitle one to property because the material for production already existed before the laborer began. He argues that labor alone is the basis of value, but that this nevertheless does not give the laborer a right to property, since his labor does not create the material out of which the product is made. It is this insight on which the language of green rights is built. Land and other natural resources are neither matters of purely private interest, nor are they purely social. The resources on which the entire society, indeed, human civilization as a whole, rests are the foundations for both personal and social well-being. We call them green rights to draw attention to this third category. Eco-justice is the more popular term to describe this same conclusion. As Li Huaibin, a leading Marxist scholar, states, "We need to protect the legally established ecological rights of individuals, families, communities, and nations, and to defend ecological equality and ecological justice. I think this is not only the intrinsic component of ecological civilization, but also the ideal and goal that Marxists and constructive postmodernists are struggling for." One sees in this short section that organic philosophy represents a radically different way of thinking. Perhaps this helps explain the opposition of capitalists and libertarian thinkers to the international environmental movement. For the common good is not just a minor modification of the individualist perspective. Even more than red, social rights, green rights lift our eyes above and beyond personal gain to the vision of an interconnected society and planet. On a small planet, no man is an island. What you own and how you live impacts the quality of life within the whole web of life, both human and non-human. Green thinking, the foundation for ecological civilization, is thus a revolutionary transformation of human thought. We suggest that it represents the next stage in the evolution of human social thought. Conclusion. It is unfortunate that many scholars and politicians still treat the discussion of human rights as a single topic. We have discovered instead that no less than three different frameworks are at work. Rights language based on freedom from interference is only the beginning, since it is motivated by the individual's wish not to be restrained or constrained. For example, the first 20 articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights begin with rights such as the right to life, security of person, fair trial, not to be held in slavery, not to be arrested arbitrarily, and so forth. One should not ignore these rights, but neither should one limit the discourse to them alone. Social theorists helped humanity extend from one-dimensional to two-dimensional thinking. Marx spoke for the heart of socialism when he included the good of society as a basic goal and not merely as a byproduct of property owners' pursuit of wealth. Societies are stronger when they acknowledge economic, social, and cultural rights. The global community has gradually accepted its responsibility to support educational and cultural activities that raise the quality of life of all citizens. With the awareness of green rights, social theory is now moving to a full three-dimensional way of thinking. Ecological civilization supplements economic and social rights with core organic values, such as the right to a healthy environment and the right to peace. Green rights are very clearly collective rather than individual rights. As one adopts this framework, one moves beyond modern individualism to constructive postmodern community-based thinking. Alfred North Whitehead recognized the radical nature of this move. The whole concept of absolute individuals with absolute rights and with a contractual power of forming fully defined external relations has broken down. The human being is inseparable from its environment in each occasion of its existence. The environment which the occasion inherits is immanent in it, and conversely, it is immanent in the environment which it helps to transmit. Chapter 8. Democracy and Justice, a Post-Liberal Perspective. What holds for freedom holds even more clearly in discussions of democracy and justice. When American school children pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, I think they hear it as, "We are the only nation with liberty and justice for all." Perhaps a few people know that Marx was striving to create a more just form of society, and that he viewed socialism as the most consistent form of democracy. But few Americans have paused to do a comparative study of liberal and socialist approaches to these topics. Few have an accurate understanding of what socialist approaches means. Justice means fairness. Since the ancient Greeks, justice has been pictured as a blindfolded woman holding a scale in her hands. Unswayed by personal gain, blind to fame or wealth of the disputing parties, she distributes the resources fairly between all parties. Some years back, Alistair MacIntyre wrote a now classic work, Whose Justice? Which Rationality? Of course, MacIntyre was not the first to recognize that the Western traditions include multiple notions of justice, and that they are worlds apart. Has the liberal tradition launched by John Locke resulted in a fair, just distribution of resources across the population? Or has it produced rules that favor the wealthiest and mete out disproportionate punishments on those who have the least? If the kind of wealth-based democracy that the U.S. and many Western nations have embraced is not just, what other options exist that might help to correct the injustices? How much have wealth-based notions of justice influenced the way that we have constructed our particular form of democracy? Democracy. The word democracy simply means rule by the people, demos. Perhaps no political arrangement has seemed as obviously desirable as this one. And yet this simple term raises a variety of probing questions. Who are the people who get to rule? Does the smaller group of people in direct positions of power within a democracy in fact rule in the interests of all the people within the country? To what extent does our system focus on the good of all human beings, present and future, citizens and non-citizens, and, indeed, on the good of all living things? And to what extent does it operate more for the short-term gains of its own citizens, and them alone? Democracy in service of the market. For Francis Fukuyama, whose The End of History a few years ago proudly proclaimed the final victory of capitalist democracy over all competitors, the answer is simple. Liberal democracy is the best system because it protects property owners from outside interference. He writes, "For Hobbes and Locke, and for their followers who wrote the American Constitution and Declaration of Independence, liberal society was a social contract between individuals who possessed certain natural rights, chief among which were the right to life, that is, self-preservation, and to the pursuit of happiness, which was generally understood as the right to private property. Liberal society is thus a reciprocal and equal agreement among citizens not to interfere with each other's lives and property. In short, Fukuyama still employs the defense of democracy developed by the early modern American and European philosophers. The route to happiness comes through owning private property. Thus, the government needs to keep others from interfering with your property. When this approach leads Fukuyama and his allies to use the language of rights, the rights they name first are the rights to life and property. As we saw in the previous chapter, organic Marxists are not opposed to the language of human rights. We do, however, recognize that the focus must extend beyond individual or blue rights, such as the right to individual freedom and property, so that it includes red and green rights as well. The same corrective is needed in discussing democracy. One can affirm with Fukuyama that democracy is the right held universally by all citizens to have a share of political power, that is, the right of all citizens to vote and participate in politics. But what we oppose, together with other supporters of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights of the United Nations, is the view that democratic government requires nothing more than the individual rights of liberalism. Fukuyama represents this view. The right to participate in political power can be thought of as yet another liberal right. Indeed, the most important one. And it is for this reason that liberalism has been closely associated historically with democracy. True, classic liberalism is one framework, one ideology, for approaching rule by the people. But it is not the only framework, and neither is it the best one. The unique contribution of any rule by the people should be that the needs of all the people are taken fully into consideration. But, unfortunately, capitalist democracy has tended to become rule by the individual for his own gain. A word on terminology. Those who hold Fukuyama's view are increasingly calling themselves libertarians in order to distinguish themselves from present-day liberals, whom they mistakenly confuse with socialists. David Boaz, executive vice president of the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., correctly understands the link between Locke's liberal tradition and free market libertarians. Libertarianism may be regarded as a political philosophy that applies the ideas of classical liberalism consistently, following liberal arguments to conclusions that would limit the role of government more strictly and protect individual freedom more fully than other classical liberals would. Boaz, as much as we disagree with his politics, has grasped the trajectory of Western liberalism much more clearly than the American moderate left. Today's libertarians have worked out the implications of the classical liberal starting point, Locke, Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, more consistently than have present-day liberals. If liberals want to avoid the libertarian conclusions, they need to incorporate another tradition within political philosophy. Only when the rampant individualism of liberalism is tempered by socialist assumptions, Marx, can the reductio ad absurdum be avoided. What then distinguishes these two major approaches, libertarian democracy and the version of democracy that we are calling organic Marxism? Europeans in the early modern period invented the concept of an implicit social contract, which became a defining feature of libertarianism. There is, they believed, an implicit agreement among the voting citizens of a country that government should serve one central role. You agree not to interfere with the life and property, wealth, of other property owners, in return for their agreement not to take your property. The rulers of the democracy are allowed to stay in power as long as they pass and enforce laws of non-interference. Everything else should be left to market competition to decide. Each property owner can and should increase his own wealth. As long as he doesn't directly harm others, all other matters belong in the private sphere and are up to him to decide. To approach political theory in this way gives markets the central role in defining democracy. The evidence is overwhelming that this arrangement has proved to be a monumentous mistake, producing gross injustices among humans and devastating the planet. It also forsakes our obligation to formulate the central values of a nation, of human civilization, and of life on Earth. It is far better, we suggest, to define democracies in terms of the common good, what they can offer their citizens and the planet, rather than in terms of what they are forbidden from doing. One should fault capitalism-based democracies not only for the unjust consequences that they have wrought on the poor and the planet. One should fault them as well for their unduly negative view of human nature, a view that has served to justify morally unacceptable treatment of non-wealthy humans and animals. Recall that the liberal tradition predicts that, left to themselves, humans will act in selfish, even antisocial ways. Thus, they argue, one needs a political system that will transform selfish motivations into outcomes that are good for others. Adam Smith discovered that if society allows each person to be selfish in the ways that he wants to be, and to amass as much wealth as he can, as long as he doesn't directly steal it from others, society as a whole will benefit. Listeners may notice, of course, that it's rather self-serving for the already wealthy to give themselves carte blanche to amass more wealth. After all, when it comes to wealth, the world is hardly a level playing field. Some are rich enough to own multinational businesses, such as Microsoft, whereas others do not have the money even to open a small storefront shop. And clearly the income between the people on the two ends of the spectrum will be massively different. Isn't this clearly a recipe for the rich to get richer? Is European-style social democracy enough? So, are social democracies the answer? At various times since the Second World War, the democracies of Northern Europe have increased the social services that the government offers to the citizens and have strengthened the social safety net for the poor and unemployed. The social reforms in these nations are certainly a step forward from the small government slogan of libertarian capitalism, which opposes social health care and cancels government programs that support those in need. Amartya Sen calls this positive democracy. In his view, it is the byproduct of reasoned debate when access is given to all citizens, and not just to the wealthy. He writes, "If the above analysis is correct, then democracy's claim to be valuable does not rest on just one particular merit. There is a plurality of virtues here, including, first, the intrinsic importance of political participation and freedom in human life. Second, the instrumental importance of political incentives in keeping governments responsible and accountable. And third, the constructive role of democracy in the formation of values and in the understanding of needs, rights, and duties." In light of this diagnosis, we may now address the motivating question of this essay, namely, the case for seeing democracy as a universal value. Sen's work shows that it's not necessary to leave behind the ideal of rule by the people in order to introduce social services and to protect the most vulnerable citizens. Democracy is not incompatible with community-based thinking. What Sen fails to recognize, however, are the inherent limits of systems that are based on Western liberal capitalism. He seeks to blend individual and social rights in his conception of social democracy, but political and economic systems that retain the individual pursuit of wealth, capitalism, as their ruling ideology, can only graft on social values and green rights as a sort of afterthought. In these systems, citizens are understood first as individual consumers who vote their own economic interests. The last decades have shown that whenever there is an economic downturn or the fear of immigration from their poorer and darker neighbors to the south, voters begin to dismantle the social services and to support protectionist policies. The European social democracies have therefore, in the end, not turned out to be a sort of beachhead for socialism. individual socially oriented policies mitigate a few of the most painful byproducts of capitalism, but without bringing the sort of systemic reforms that are necessary. The big picture is still controlled by the class of the wealthiest companies and individuals, who continue to act in and to vote their own interests. Social reforms depend on excess wealth. They are expanded only when there is a sense of relative stability and the absence of threat. As long as the basic economic structure of these nations remains unchanged, social policies remain vulnerable. This is not the foundation that is required for long-term ecological sustainability and a global community oriented toward long-term peace and cooperation. Organic Marxism for the Common Good. From the standpoint of organic Marxism, more fundamental changes are necessary within Western capitalist democracies if they are going to overcome unsustainable economic practices and domination by the wealthiest 1%. We name three in particular, without which the current system will continue to work against genuine reform. First and foremost, there has to be a change in power relations. Currently, the owners, the wealthy, control the reins of government. Most legislation furthers their interests. The voices of the working class and the poor are heard dimly, when at all. No true rule by the people, democracy, exists as long as power is not really shared with the people. Second, social values, the so-called red and green rights, must become foundational to the political and economic systems, rather than allowing the individual pursuit of wealth and comfort to be the driving motor of the state. Only when blue rights are not the sole raison d'être of the state will social and environmental interests begin to play a significant role in government decision-making. Accompanying the first two changes must be the establishment of community structures and community-based thinking. There simply is no way to achieve a truly democratic society, society for the common good, without local groups with decision-making powers that meet the human needs for community. Environmental collapse, scientists tell us, will bring the collapse of broader social and economic systems. National governments will not be able to address all the crises that arise. Communities will find themselves forced to become more self-reliant, which is possible only when we develop effective communal structures. It is also true that, in the absence of significant community involvement, people feel depersonalized. Depersonalization produces apathy, and apathy produces a power vacuum. Inevitably, non-community-based power structures move in to fill the vacuum. Bureaucracy in socialist systems, and profit-driven corporations in capitalist systems. In turning away from this direction, organic Marxism shifts the focus from an individualistic to a communitarian perspective. Communitarianism has been growing in response to the weaknesses in the liberal system, and we predict that it will play an increasingly significant role as the environmental crisis looms ever larger. Community-based economics thus lies at the heart of a vibrant democratic socialism. The classic expression of this economic theory, Cobb and Daly's For the Common Good, Redirecting the Economy Towards Community, the Environment, and a Sustainable Future, remains the manifesto for the economics of organic Marxism. Cobb and Daly write, "The alternative is to think of the larger community normatively as a community of communities. One's local community would then become a primary basis for self-identification, and participation in its affairs would take on greater importance for two reasons. First, there would be some increase in the significance of local decisions. Second, the representatives chosen locally would participate in important decisions at higher levels, and in the selection of representatives to still higher levels. Personal identification would continue to operate at several levels to varying degrees." Cobb and Daly remain true to the heritage of classical Marxism. Their vision extends all the way from their critique of unsustainable growth-based economic models to their proposal of a radically new economic order. like Marx before them, they realize that a post-capitalist economy will bring with it a withering away of the state. As Engels put it, they recognize that nationalist competition inevitably conflicts with global ecological thinking. The proposal of conceiving the world normatively as a community of communities is an attenuation of the idea of sovereignty. There should be no sovereign states, nations, or global government. The presently sovereign nation-states would retain important roles, but devolve others on smaller units and surrender still others to the United Nations. All communities would exercise some sovereignty, but none would be sovereign in the sense of modern political theory. The myths of social contract on which these modern theories of political sovereignty were based are obviously false historically. They also distort both theory and practice. Of course, nations will not easily give up their controlling power on the global stage and the myopia that accompanies this power. Even the most enlightened of the Northern European social democracies still assume that the nation-state would be able to define and pursue its own self-interests. Much, therefore, depends on how rapidly global climate change causes the collapse of individual nation-states and of the economic structures that currently control global trade. In one sense, we hope the collapse will proceed slowly, since, in that case, the costs to human life and biodiversity will be lower. Also, if the collapse is slow, the world will see a period when independent states are run according to social democratic principles. By contrast, if the collapse of the global infrastructure is rapid, as Cobb and Daly believe, then economic interactions among the survivors will of necessity occur only within some communities and regions. In this case, one can only hope that the gradual rebuilding of global trade will function according to Cobb and Daly's model of the community of communities, rather than on the model of sovereign nations that has wreaked so much havoc on this planet. Justice. We saw that organic Marxism accepts a higher mandate, to work for the common good of all persons. It challenges the privileging of the wealthy that dominates Western democracies today. Only government of the people, by the people, for the people, President Lincoln, Gettysburg Address, is truly democratic government. A nation run by the wealthy, for the wealthy, is democracy in name alone. We will now discover that, of the four central concepts explored in this and the preceding chapter, the concept of justice sheds perhaps the clearest light on the transition that is required. Unfortunately, our discussion of the various models of democracy was still a bit formal. It accomplished the move from individual to communal, but it didn't communicate enough about the specific values by which these communities live. By contrast, a probing discussion of justice issues and of specific injustices brings a greater degree of concreteness. In the process, one learns more about the actual policies of societies that are built around the central principles of organic Marxism. The most urgent justice issue raised in politics and economics is the question of distributive justice. Within a society, what methods of distributing economic burdens and benefits are unjust, and what practices maximize justice? The positions discussed by philosophers fall along a clear continuum. Furthest to the right is the desert theory of justice, as in, to get your just deserts. Those who work hard deserve the riches that they acquire. Hence, it's unjust to use any of their wealth in order to keep people in poverty. In the middle are egalitarian positions, which insist that distribution of resources should be equal across the population. The famous Harvard philosopher John Rawls is often associated with this position, though some believe he fits more naturally under the next heading. Next to the left are those positions that seek to maximize some value across the society, such as overall welfare, access to education, quality of life, the capacity to succeed, etc. In this case, The principle of distribution is not conceived at the individual level, but across the whole society. Finally, at the far end of the spectrum from the desert theory, is the Marxist answer. Maximize contributions from those who are most able to give them, and prioritize distributions to those who need them most. It will come as no surprise to hear that the early modern European philosophers advocated the positions on the far right end of this